day and welcome to the Advancing Learning Podcast with me, Will Rickson, and Harry Waters. Today's episode is brought to you by Ready4, a course that's been helping students prepare for their exams for over 20 years. The brand new Ready4C2 proficiency level is the latest in the series and continues to provide the in-depth exam training for which the course is known. Enjoy the episode. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Advancing Learning Podcast. I am Will Rickson, and I'm joined by two extremely special people. The first one is Harry Waters.
Hello.
Good to see you again, Hazza, as always.
A pleasure as always, kind sir.
And also joined by our Macmillan's friend and partner of long, long ago is Adrian Underhill. Welcome, Adrian.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Absolute pleasure. Great to have you. Okay, so having Adrian Underhill here, there's no surprise, I think, to me what sort of direction we're heading in today. We're going to be talking about pronunciation, its role in the classroom to date, and how Adrian has got some ideas, and we have got some ideas we'd like to share of how pronunciation might be taught in the classroom in 2024. But let's start from the top. Can one of you just answer this question? I have a burning question. Why should we be teaching pronunciation? Why is it important?
Oof, that's a big question, isn't it? Why is it important to teach pronunciation? I think there are a few answers to that one. I think one that we focus on a lot as teachers is we need our students to talk proper, of course. But I think one that we often forget about is we also need them to listen proper as well. So for me, I think it's not just about the way our students speak and the way they sound, but it's also about the way they hear and the way they interpret information. I'm going to hand over to an absolute legend of pronunciation, Mr. Adrian Underhill. Why do you think it's important?
Well, Harry, thank you. First, for the reasons that you've just said, so that people can find their way into aspects of speaking and making sounds which are not the same as their mother tongue, and that needs some assistance because the sounds are different and therefore the muscles are different. And as you also say, because listening is integral to that. And we often find that you can't actually hear something in a new language until you can say it, which is the opposite way around from what the behaviorists used to say, because they would say, listen first, then speak. But there's a good case for speak first, work on it, then you can hear. So there's that, I think. And there's one other thing I would add to those two things you just mentioned, and that is that since pronunciation is a physical activity, it is experienced in the body. It's an active, energetic activity. And with that goes a great deal of personal engagement and investment in the language, I think.
And in order to get that engagement, that you know, very proactive involvement from that person, physical involvement in the activity, they need to have that push behind. They need to have a reason to be able to do that. So we've spoken already about them being able to speak, but what we spoke about before the session was the reason why people would like to be speaking with, you know, whatever good pronunciation might be. And we spoke before about some students wanting to sound like a native English speaker. But in actual fact, the end goal might just be to be intelligible, no? To be understandable when you speak.
Yes, to be intelligible in speaking and listening is a really good aim. And I think many learners will be satisfied with that. But people that want to go further than that and to adopt a particular accent, say an American kind of accent or an English kind of accent, to speak quicker or slower, to drop certain sounds, to speak with a certain slang, anyone who wants to do that can do so if they're interested enough and if they're prepared to work on it. Actually, the sky's the limit to how you can sound if you want to.
I think one of the big misconceptions when it comes to pronunciation is the big confusion between accent and pronunciation. Yes, of course, we can work on it and we can build up our level and so on. Like when I speak in Spanish, a lot of people say I sound like, you know, I have a lot of Southern Spanish sound within my accent, but I still sound British, you know, like a British person speaking Spanish. So there are lots of areas we can work on. And yeah, I think it's it's quite often people kind of get in that headspace that they're so obsessed with that and they don't notice their progression. At the end of the day, they are really progressing. They are coming along really well, but they often compare themselves against a so-called native speaker and think, oh, I'm not there yet. When really they're making leaps and bounds in their progression.
That's a really important point, because the better they get, the more discerning they get. Therefore, they can discern with increasing subtlety the gap between them and the people they're listening to. And they're not getting worse. They're actually getting a lot better, as you say.
So that's why. Now, we're going to look at some of the areas on where we can improve with teaching and pronunciation, especially. Now, I know that when I started focusing on pronunciation in my classes and I started focusing on it in teacher training and stuff like that, there was a lot of fear behind teaching about pronunciation because there's so much meta language involved, you know, and it seems so complex, you know, that there's the phonemic chart, which if you look at it at first, it's pretty scary to look at. And then there's lots of complex words like elision and stuff like that. And it all becomes very scary. But once you have assimilated that knowledge as a teacher, and you get into the classroom, there are often issues there. What do you think about those issues?
Well, I agree that in the training of many teachers, CELTA, DELTA, masters, and so on, there is a lot of meta language, and that comes from linguistics, and that's fine, but it's not necessarily what students need, and it doesn't necessarily give teachers what they actually need, because the students don't need that meta language. The teacher learns what I would call they know about language, they know about pronunciation, but the student needs know how. And that means they need to contact their muscles from the inside, not to classify them and know about them and know, list the articulations and know which. They actually need to experience that from the inside, which doesn't need any of that jargon. It's a different activity, it's a physical activity and not a cognitive activity. So I think there's a big gap there, and the teacher comes off with all this perfect, wonderful, insightful, and useful, perhaps in some ways, knowledge about how sounds are made. And the student enters that and finds it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't actually help her or him. And so a second fear, there's the fear of the jargon, but a second fear raises its head, which is that it doesn't make any difference to the student's pronunciation.
Do you think that there's a failure there in the actual teachings of pronunciation in the teacher training certifications that teachers go through? I did the DIP-TESOL and I had to do a Viva on pronunciation. And the Viva was all on, as you're saying, that it's all on my knowledge of pronunciation and writing the phonemic chart and any speech features that might appear in a particular sentence, for example, and then talk with the interviewer about that particular sentence. So it's very much about my knowledge of pronunciation. But I don't actually remember very much instruction on the course on how to impart that onto the students, as you're saying. There's the actual instruction of pronunciation rather than the knowledge of it. Do you think there's a failure there?
I think there's a number of failures. One of the failures is that we end up resorting to repetition. Repetition is not a way of learning. It's a way of practicing something where you already have got it. But repetition does not get you out of a habit. You can't repeat your way out of a muscular habit. You've got to rearrange the muscles, ask them to do something different, which is a bit tricky. And once they twigged that, then you can practice and perhaps repeat. But you've got to know what it is that the muscles need to do first. So that's the big thing, isn't it? So we need to start all of our pronunciation work, and this is what I try to do, with the muscles from the inside. It's easier to demonstrate than to speak, but there are quite a number of ways of going about that, which engage the student, because straight away they're making contact with what makes the difference, that is their muscles, which they don't contact if they just repeat things. And indeed, the teacher doesn't contact if she or he just studies the know about, what I call hollow knowledge, the knowledge about something. And what we need is what fills the hollow in hollow knowledge is physical experience.
One of the big issues as well with repetition is we often do it as a class. You know, so we say a sentence and we say, okay, class, now all of you repeat that. How are you going to pick up on an individual's pronunciation if you've got a chorus of people coming back at you? Okay, well, we've done that sentence three times now. You must all have it perfectly. Now let's continue. Let's do something completely different. We've done the prompt slot of the class. Let's move on to the next slot.
That's a very good characterization, because you do the repetition and the teacher probably says, right, good. Or even individually around the class, and the teacher says, good, good, good. But the students can hear it isn't good. They know perfectly well it is not like the original model. And they're not being helped to get there. Instead, they're being told that what they can hear isn't good is.
It is often the case because, yeah, the teacher is, as I mentioned, this is something you mentioned, that the kind of, I'm doing inverted commas here, failures in pronunciation teaching. And that is this prompt slot in the classroom, or this prompt slot in the book, or wherever it is. And it's that little section where, okay, we need to tick this box, so we'll do that. And that way we're not actually teaching pronunciation, we're just going through the motions, it kind of seems.
Yeah, and then it's forgotten, and then we move on, yeah.
And often the prompt slot doesn't arise out of the immediate bit of language we're doing with the grammar or vocabulary, but it arises a bit later on Friday afternoon, out of a separate part of the course book, which has isolated some things and uses another bit of language, not the bit that we were using at the moment when it arose some 2 days ago. So the whole thing's very clunky and clumsy. And you learn to say one bit of language with the words in the right order. And then on Friday afternoon, you learn to say another bit of language with the sounds right, but you don't put the two together.
Something else that I loved that you've mentioned here, and that is the ignoring the use of the inner voice. I'd love it if you could tell us a bit more about, you know, what you mean by that with pronunciation.
Probably most people experience that they can record, so to speak, hold something in short memory for a few seconds. So you look at a phone number and you're going to dial it. So you say it in your head, then you listen to what's in your head as you dial it. Or you go to the supermarket and you hear some awful music, and at home you're unpacking your groceries and that awful music is still in your head. That there is a kind of, so to speak, temporary recording which you can listen to later. Now, in language, you can hear a so-called model, what the teacher said, one sentence, one word, one sound, or listen to it on a recording. And you just hear it once. And then if you listen inside, you can hear it again several times. It won't be perfect, but it will be there registered in some form. You do what you can with it. And then if you need it again, have it again. So you're not bombarded with external models. You have one and do what you can with it. That's inner listening. Then inner speaking would be when you are preparing to say something, and in your mind, you get the words right, like in another country, preparing what to say when you walk into the shop to buy a cake or something. And you just get the right words in the right order, listen to it, adjust it, perhaps get the speed up a bit and run the words together, whatever. And that is your inner voice at work. You may even feel sort of muscles twitching, but you're not actually speaking aloud. So those are the two aspects of inner hearing and preparation to speak. Then you might go into the shop and say it, and it comes out external speaking, and you then notice that what you've said is not as good as what you had prepared. And that is a brilliant discovery, because you realize that the muscles then start getting in the way. So you go back inside and you may get an improved version, and you can then try again. So there's a whole rich area of practice and rehearsal prior to speaking aloud.
I think that's really important. That's not something that I'd really focused on in a long time, of just going through it in your head, how it's supposed to sound. I mean, I sometimes get my students when they're doing a reading, I say to them, read this in your head in a Scottish accent, or read this in your head in a, and I try and get them to work, because in your head, you can do anything. You can make any sound in your head if you work on it. I've never really thought about that.
I think I had thought about that. And I think it was something you had said before, Adrian, because you have some videos on YouTube of going through the phonemic chart, every sound of the phonemic chart in detail. You've got anywhere between 3 and 2 or 3 and 6 minutes long. And in there, you talk about internalizing those sounds quite a lot. And I can see you take a lot of effort not to say the sound until absolutely necessary. So you give people time to really internalize those sounds before they start uttering them. So I had heard about that from you because of them.
Thank you. And the point that you raised there is that if we depend on repeating after the teacher says something, the students repeat, and then it's gone. There's no real effort. It's a parroting. And in a parroting, there is not necessarily insight. The teacher then says it again, the students say it again. And so that's not learning. It's an activity, and it's not without value, but it's not learning new sounds.
For lots of people, preparing for exams can be a real challenge. This is the case not only for students, but also for teachers. Today's episode was brought to you by Ready4, which has been at the side of teachers preparing students for examinations for over 20 years. The newest addition of the Ready4 family is the C2 proficiency level, which, as you heard in the episode, helps prepare for the C2 proficiency exam, a tricky step in language learners' journeys. Luckily, Ready for C2 is packed full of tips, strategies, and exercises to ensure both teacher and students are ready to take on the challenge. From new idiom sections, innovative pronunciation exercises, and the always loved Ready4 sections, to the innovative assessment area in ME, that's Macmillan Education Everywhere app for teachers. You can be sure of success. If you want to learn more, why not take a look at the sample material using the link in the episode description. Back to the episode.
Can I go back to your point then, Harry? So you were talking, and I completely agree that at the moment there seems to be this pronunciation, bizarre. Now let's do pronunciation for 5 minutes and then move on and completely forget about it. What's the alternative then? What are we saying here? When should this be done throughout the course of, a 1 hour lesson?
For me, it varies when I'm working with my students. I mostly at the moment work with younger learners and some teens. It really varies. It all depends on what we're doing and what comes up as to when we focus on the pronunciation and the areas of it. So I'd like to know what Adrian's approach is.
I suppose my approach is that just as most teachers will integrate the right words with the right bit of grammar and require those two things to coexist together in an utterance before passing on, I simply add the pronunciation, because that is the glue that holds the whole thing together. And since I don't have to stop a lesson to move into a slot, a prawn slot to do that, but I can work exactly with what's said, as teachers can, because we see it happening, I just include pronunciation in everything that happens. It is what holds it together. And indeed, when you've got the right words in the right order and you want to practice it a bit, what better than to rehearse it by working on the prawn? And by prawn, we mean the sounds, the connected words, and the flowing speech.
So then, Harry, you spoke earlier about there being a chorus when you say, let's repeat after me and say... So how do you manage that in a classroom when you have that class of students and they're practicing maybe a sentence or a piece of grammar with the vocabulary and the pronunciation in one? They've got that. They've got their piece that they're practicing. They're practicing to output. Is there some way that you can manage, would you call it error correction, if you wanted to sort of find out where there are still things happening where you need to sort of be there and help them and be a facilitator for their pronunciation to be improved? How could you do that in a whole class setting like that?
I personally try and get as much time as I can one-on-one with students. So if it is a certain phrase or a certain, a chunk of language, I try and make sure that I am able to listen to them, but also, they can listen to each other and they can hear how it's going. So that would be what I would do.
I'm back fully what you said, Harry. And the thing I would add to it, which... you didn't say, but probably would have, is this, that I'd work with one student and that work would be very public. I would classify, if you can say that such a word, that one student. It would be a little drama. They might even come to the front. I should add that in my lessons, we go through the embarrassment barrier really early on so people can speak and not be judged. It is fun, it's enjoyable, it's exploratory, a lot of laughter. So you can have a person and I'm working with them, and they're just on the edge of getting it, and they're getting it, and they're losing, they're getting it, and they're losing it. And just at that moment, I ask him and her, have a go. And perhaps they can do it, or perhaps they can't, or perhaps they do it but make another error. And we go down that other error just for 5 seconds and then come back to this one. So this one is working on behalf of everybody. And because they have my complete engagement and attention, and because the students can hear that I'm not judging them or wishing them to hurry up, but I'm completely with them. They too are not judging that student or hurry up that student, and they too are rehearsing. And you find that the one who I haven't worked with at all has managed through this proxy work to get what the student at the front was working on. And when I say student at the front, there may be several students at the front.
I love that idea. Yeah, I completely get it. I love the idea of classifying. I've never heard of that term before. I think it might be behind the curve. I love the idea of classifying feedback like that.
One of the things I often do as well with my students, because I teach here in Spain, I also teach online as well, but with my Spanish students, to get rid of that kind of fear of making mistakes, is I show them that, you know, I speak in Spanish. I've been here for 14 years, but I still make mistakes. So I would openly get them to teach me something in Spanish to show that, you know, that we're all on the same level. And we're all learners of languages. We all make mistakes. We all need help. We all need practice.
I think you put your finger on something which is really important here in the psychology of a lesson, and that is that we are all in the same boat. We are all learning. And the students are learning the language, and I'm learning the students. And I'm also learning something about the language, and I'm finding those sounds in my mouth. Now, this is a crucial thing, and I should add that to the classifying. If a student is making an error, let's say it's a sound, let's say they're just making the sound or instead of or, duh instead of door, then if that's the vowel, I might say, okay, can you say that again? Yeah, all right. Can you hear that, everyone? All right. So what I think you're saying is, oh, and now I'm talking to myself, like soliloquy. I'm talking, for everyone can hear. Oh, now she's saying, oh, and the sound we want is, oh. Then we go, oh, then I slide between two. Oh, oh, now what am I doing? Oh, my tongue's going back. Oh, and my lips coming forward. Oh, I get it, yes. Now, they have seen me learn her mistake, a journey from her mistake to where we're the destination. It's not repeat after me. They've seen my, and I'm talking aloud, soliloquy style. So, oh, my tongue moves. And it's not that I've learned that the difference between oh and oh is lip position and tongue position from a book. I'm discovering that here now in the class in front of them in my mouth. And they can see and feel that. And by the end of it, half of them are halfway there in any case. So this is really adding to Harry's point about that we are learners and I'm learning them and where they are and they are working on the language. And that puts us on the same side of the learning fence.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like a really sort of, I'm picturing quite a magical scene in the classroom at the moment. I don't know about you, Harry. I've got a very magical scene of Adrian with those students in that classroom. It just looks like the most pretty picture of a classroom, I thought, for a while.
And what's more, if the teacher doesn't do that, if the teacher can't find the student sound in his own mouth, then how can he help the student? Mm. All he can say is repeat after me, which is what everybody does, and everyone knows it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, we persist with that. 50 years we've been saying repeat after me.
Can I ask how you sort of breezed past it the other day, but I think what you spoke about breaking that barrier straight away and students not being so self-conscious and feeling free to make mistakes and pronounce and to say things in a certain way. I would say that there are some teachers in the world have struggled with that for some time, to make students feel that comfortable, to pronounce things and to make errors in front of the class on forum like that. I know this is a bit of a sidestep, but how do you do that?
Well, like I said, the way I do it is I try and like put ourselves all on the same, you know, as we mentioned before, show that we're all learners and show that this is a safe space, you know, that it's okay to be here, to say what you want to say and to just, it's all okay. And it can take time with some learners. And, you know, when you are classifying these areas and these situations, to make sure you bring up the more confident students first so they can show that it's okay to make mistakes. And then, you know, slowly but surely, other students will get on board, is what I would say.
Exactly. And when a student makes a mistake, to not go quiet, but to approach them, to listen boldly, to have them say it boldly, to get others to say it. I say to the students, listen to the differences as we go around the class, not listen to who's correct. Listen to the, can you hear the difference? Oh, yeah, 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 we can hear the differences. Okay, can you say like her? Can you say like him? Okay, say it like yourself. Get people to not see correct as the big success. It is where we're going to end up. It's true. But there's a lot of journeying along the way. You know, when you go on a trip, you don't just get on a plane to arrive. You actually maybe walk there, and there's a lot of adventure along the way. I think that it is important, and non-judgment and pleasure in the student trying something is very important. They are not saying something to satisfy me. They're saying something to see for themselves what they're doing, and I'm helping them to do that.
I suppose that's got a lot to do with your inner intent as well. If, you know, if you've got a good motivation behind the things that you're doing with them, it'll pour out of you and they'll see straight away that you're not there to try and catch them out. You're not there trying to make them feel smaller. You're genuinely just trying to help them.
And you're not there to hurry up, which means you can probably go quicker. And you're on their side.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Absolutely. Well, I think we're going to pull it to a close there, if that's all right with you two. But before we do, Adrian, final words. If you're speaking to... Imagine you've got every teacher in the world in front of you now. They are teaching in that way that you believe should be improved. If you could say one thing to them all now, what would you say?
I would say that pronunciation is physical, not cognitive. So that suggests a direction to work in. And the way of working is not to tell them things, but to ask them to look at what's happening in simply with their tongue, their lips, and their jaw. And compare that with the sound and ask them what's going on inside so they can begin to see and feel and sense the territory where it all comes from.
Brilliant. And Hazza, final words?
I can't follow that.
They are all there. They are all there.
They're all waiting there.
Bated breath, they're waiting.
What would I say? Listen to what Adrian just said.
Oh, that's a good one. Listen to Adrian Underhill. That's always a good piece of advice, isn't it?
Pretty good advice, if you ask me. I've really, really enjoyed today. It's taken me back to about a decade when I got mildly obsessed with pronunciation.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite a while. I was very deep into it in my early teacher training days. Of course, I still use it in my classes, but this was it was really lovely to dive back in and have a new look on things. So. Yeah, and a huge thanks. And I'm not wearing my hat, but I'm taking my hat off now.
Can I just make one final comment, which is that for me, learning, we are learning beings, and that to be learning is to be in touch with our own development and indeed some level with evolution, and that learning is a joyful activity. And you can see that in tiny toddlers and so on. And therefore, I am looking for joy in the class. I believe firmly that learning is joyful. And if it's not joyful, it's not learning. It's something else.
Oh, I don't want to even want to close. I just want to... All right, podcast over. Bye, everyone.
Thanks again for listening to the Advancing Learning podcast from Macmillan Education. Don't forget to pay macmillaneducation.es/readyfour a visit to find out more about the Ready4 series.